It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Sandy Rios back with you, and a pleasure it is. I'm still at Radio Row, but by the time you hear this, I will not be. But it's my pleasure to introduce our next guest. He was with the FBI for a number of years, I think sort of a contemporary with my husband. His name is James Conway, and in the FBI, he served as a terrorism expert and with a Latin American focus. My understanding is that Jim went into that right after the attacks of 9/11. I have to say that the FBI before that, true or not, James, was really doing crime, domestic crime, not terrorism, right? This was new.
Well, yeah, it was and it wasn't. I worked organized crime for about 10 years, and then really the last 10 or 15 years of my career, even a few years before 9/11, okay. You know, the FBI still, terrorism was a focus of ours, going back to the USS Cole and going back to the
Cobar Towers.
Yeah, Cobar Towers, mm-hmm. and all those things. Mm-hmm. So we always had joint terrorism task forces. They started in the early 80s, and I was actually ended up supervising a joint terrorism task force in Houston in the late 90s. And then, that of course, 9/11 changed everything, and terrorism became a major focus of the FBI.
Was the FBI prior to 9/11 traveling overseas and doing kind of taking the lead on some of these investigations like they, under Mueller, they later did?
Yeah, sure. USS Cole and, of course, the Cobar Towers, Pan Am 103. Some friends of mine from the Washington field office here worked that case. Of course, we didn't have the global footprint we had in those days. We had about 25 offices overseas back in the 80s and early 90s. And now, fast forward to 2018, we've got about 70 offices overseas. And, you know, some people say, what's the FBI doing in all these countries? But the reality is we live in a global world today, whether you're talking about business or you're talking about intelligence or law enforcement. Most of our investigations have an international nexus, whether we need telephone traffic information, we need bank records, we need interviews, we need to find missing children, whatever it might be. Everything has an international component. So we have offices overseas to meet those needs of the FBI.
Where were you on 9/11?
I was driving into the office for a squad meeting at 7:45 when I heard that a plane had hit one of the towers. And when I heard the second plane hit, and it was an airliner, I knew immediately it was Al-Qaeda.
Really?
Oh, yeah, because the ground had been vibrating all summer. You might remember back in July and August, we had shut down most of our embassy, a lot of our embassies, in particular Sofia, Bulgaria, in Europe. We thought there was going to be, the intelligence community thought there was going, they knew that the ground was vibrating and Al-Qaeda was going to try another attack, but due to a lack of coordination and intelligence, we thought it was going to be in Europe. And suddenly we were hit in New York. And when we were hit, I knew what it was.
Yeah. Did you feel that the revelations that at least some in the FBI should have known, these guys were training in Arizona, did you think that was a legitimate criticism?
Yeah, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. In fairness, some of those walls have come down. People have to understand that it was against the law, and as a result of the church hearings in the late 70s, in the early 80s, mm-hmm. that the intelligence community could not share a lot of information with the FBI. The CIA could not unilaterally share everything with the FBI, and to a certain extent, I think lawmakers up on the Hill here were afraid we'd have too big a police state if they did, but... a lot of those walls have come down, and we've seen greater cooperation, and hopefully that's for the betterment of our national security. But, yes, there were some things missed, and hopefully in the future we'll be able to connect those dots and get out in front. And, you know, the FBI has done a great – I mean, they've thwarted over 100 potential attacks in the United States. But, you know, it's like being a goalie in the World Cup. You know, you can make 100 saves, but one gets by you, and everybody criticizes you. So
let me just make a comment on that church hearing, because just historical perspective, this is my perspective. We were coming out of the radical era of the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. and I think a lot might, again, my interpretation of this, that a lot of the radicals who were active on the streets during the 60s and 70s actually got elected to Congress. And so, seriously. And so
Weather
the church,
Underground, SDS, yeah, all those people.
So the church committee, you know, did their bidding. They hamstrung law enforcement. That's the untold story. So that when 9/11 came, the FBI was hamstrung because there were these prohibitions between sharing information.
I think you're right.
So that's just something, just a kind of a word to the wise. We don't want to repeat that.
Yeah.
You left the FBI
about 9 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. I stay in the game, though. I'm still doing a lot of training, and I'm working.
Oh, yeah, you're with a company. You travel around the world.
Yeah, I'm doing some training, most of it on behalf of the State Department, which is a great program. It's providing counterterrorism training, counterterrorism strategies, intelligence cycle, critical incident management, returning foreign fighters. We're doing a lot of training in that area, and I'm a part and parcel of that. And I enjoy it tremendously because it keeps me in the game a little bit. I get to meet with young people who are on the front lines, mm-hmm. boots on the ground in their countries. I've trained in South Asia and Africa and South America and the Middle East and North Africa. And I work with the folks that are doing counterterrorism, that are responsible for counterterrorism in those countries. And I enjoy it. I enjoy sharing. You know, we as Americans, we don't have all the answers, but we share some concepts and methods we hope will help them.
You know, Andy McCarthy is a friend, and you probably know when he prosecuted the Blind Sheikh and the First World Trade Center bombing. Andy, because it was a Muslim, the Blind Sheikh was a Muslim cleric, mm-hmm. and he was an academic in the Islamic world. Andy made it his business to really study Islam and started writing, you know, mm-hmm. all these books, The Grand Jihad and all mm-hmm. kinds of stuff. So I'm wondering what the FBI was doing then. Were you free to explore and read Andy's books and teach that to people that you talked to?
Yeah.
Like Andy's an example.
Go back to the Blind Sheikh, I mean, sometimes you wonder, what are we doing in this country? I mean, the Egyptian government told us when he applied for a religious visa, this guy is dangerous. He has served time in support of the Muslim Brotherhood here. He is preaching jihad. He is preaching violence. But yet, our State Department gave him a religious visa to come to the United States. And he took over a mosque in northern New Jersey and, along with others, conspired to take out a U.S. target in the form of, at that time, the World Trade Center. So it goes up and beyond the FBI. But look, in terms of investigations, I mean, we look at the radar screen. We share with our counterparts. We have referrals from foreign governments. And we do everything we can under the law to investigate and hopefully get out in front of potential acts of terrorism in the United States.
But I think the real issue, James, of course, you know that I speak as a I've led with it, that my husband, my listeners know this, my husband was at the FBI for years, mm-hmm. and because of the work I do in Washington, this is an area, the whole business, just particularly right now with the FBI in regard to the teaching, understanding who terrorists are, Islamic terrorists mm-hmm. specifically. When the Quantico, you know, purged the training manuals so that mm-hmm. young agents now for, I don't know, maybe approaching 10, 15 years now, don't have a clue about where this is coming from. And when I personally know that the FBI director, Mueller, mm-hmm. In a private conversation overseas, wondered, why do they hate us so much? What's this all about? And the person he talked to was just stunned. Like, you don't really understand? This has been going on for centuries. He didn't say this, but I'm saying this has been going on for centuries. It's the same pattern. It's death to the infidel, or or subjugation. You don't know this, and you're heading the FBI. I mean, honestly, James, you served during that time. How did you? You must have known a lot. So how did you handle that transition where then suddenly you can't talk about that stuff?
Yeah, the purging of the basis of that particular terrorist ideology comes from all ends of the spectrum. But in terms of radical fundamentalist jihad, It is my understanding that actually happened after I left, but I will tell you that it looks as though that was done in the spirit of cooperation and by pressure from outside groups who said this is anti, this is Islamophobic, this is anti-Islamic.
Look, I wonder who said that. Probably CARE.
I don't know.
They did. Yeah, Council for American Islamic Relations, the PR arm of the Muslim Brotherhood, was the one who said that.
And but I would hope that FBI agents are smart people, mm-hmm. are well-read people, and they can understand that irrespective of the ideology, they know and can recognize the criminal element within those ideologies.
Well, the FBI has been in the news a little bit lately, yeah. James. And I'm just curious to know, how do you think that news, that whole plethora that about the way the FBI has handled some things in regard to Trump's political campaign and the Russian collusion and all that. Peter Strzok, I can, you know the list. You know them better. Their names better than I do. How do you think that's affected agents like you?
It's a sad chapter in our history. And I hope that we can overcome this. And I hope we can begin to move from this. Those people have been removed. We need the support of the American people. The American people need us and we need them. My fear is that when FBI agents go out, hopefully not, but if they go out tomorrow night at dusk and looking for a little girl that's missing, and they start knocking on doors as I used to do, we hope that people answer the door and they will talk to us and they will cooperate with us and they will work with us because we need the American people. And it's sad that we have been bruised as badly as we have by this, by people who came in and took the blinders off and for political motivations, it appears, that dictated their direction and the way that they approached an investigation. The mission of the FBI is critical to the American people and to the safety and security of this nation.
I agree with you, and I think that's the part, that kind of the untold story, that when now you go out and you're trying to investigate, mm-hmm. people have look at you differently, whereas there used to be so much respect, as you well know. You experienced that.
Right.
And the other thing is testifying in court. The FBI used to be taken at their word because you were punished internally, if you like.
Absolutely.
And so now... That affects how you your ability to for judges to hear, listen, and respect and believe your account.
In any relationship in life, mm-hmm. if you lose credibility and you lose trust, you lose everything.
Yeah.
So I'm concerned about that. But I have confidence that the 99.99% of the FBI, the folks that are out there, the boots on the ground, the people that are working the streets of America, are trying to do the right thing. One of the things I'd like to see, Sandy, is I would like to see directors of the FBI be former FBI officials.
Totally.
When we go across the street to the Department of Justice, which is a very political place, and we start bringing people in with a political perspective instead of a pure law enforcement perspective to run the FBI, I think that's where we've missed a lot of times. But that's been a congressional sort of, not mandate, but sort of a congressional thing is we want to keep control of these guys, this organization called the FBI. So we're always going to have some DOJ official come over and manage the FBI. And I would like to see, you know, we had a director, if you go all the way back to Louis Free, he was, a federal judge and so forth, but he was a former FBI agent. He understood our culture. He fully understood our mission. Mm-hmm. He understood the apolitical posture that the FBI needs and must have. Look, numerous presidents tried to politicize the Bureau going all the way back to the 50s and 60s, and it was resisted, and it needs to be resisted. We need to put the blinders on strictly just the facts, gather the facts, gather the evidence, and put together cases objectively, irrespective of political opinions.
And
we all have political feelings in our hearts.
Yes.
But when you go to work, you got to do your job.
Totally. James Conway, again, former FBI terrorism expert, Latin American focus. He's still working, traveling all over the world, training people and on the front lines of defense. So thank you, Jim. James, for your service to our country.
Thank you, Sandy.
All right.
Pleasure to be with you.
Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Both the press secretary and the president pushing back hard late this afternoon, Brett, on this anonymously authored op-ed in the New York Times. In a lengthy statement, we'll only read part of it, Sarah Huckabee Sanders saying, quote, "We are disappointed but not surprised that the paper chose to publish this pathetic, reckless, and selfish op-ed. This coward should do the right thing and resign." At a law enforcement officer event, sheriff's event, in the past hour, the president running down a long list of what he says are accomplishments that his administration has achieved over the past 16 or 18 months, and also saying that the New York Times publishing an anonymous op-ed was an absolutely gutless move.
Nobody has ever done in less than a two-year period what we've done. So when you tell me about some anonymous source within the administration, probably who's failing and probably here for all the wrong reasons.
The unidentified official says he is part of the resistance in the White House that believes the president continues to act in a manner that is detrimental to the health of our republic. The author says he and other like-minded administration officials are working to insulate the government from what he calls the president's misguided impulses. Meetings with him veer off topic and off the rails. He engages in repetitive rants, and his impulsiveness results in half-baked, ill-informed, and occasionally reckless decisions that have to be walked back. The official says the resistance wants the Trump White House to succeed, but adds successes have come despite, not because of, the president's leadership style, which is impetuous, adversarial, petty, and ineffective.
Sandy Rios with you. That's not a new story that is breaking. Actually, when I'm speaking, it's breaking less than 24 hours before this. But, and we've been talking about it for several days by the time you'll hear this, but Congressman Jim Jordan has joined me here at Radio Row at the Phoenix Park Hotel, and this is the Fair Immigration Radio Row, which has been such a pleasure to be a part of. Congressman, by the time they hear this, we may even know who it is. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about first impressions. I've said plenty about it, but I'd like to know what you think about somebody in resistance writing for the New York Times from the White House.
Yeah, look, it's an opinion piece. Put the person's name on it, or the person whose opinion it is should put their name. It's not a news story per se. It's an opinion piece. It's on the op-ed page. So that to me is just laughable. Like, come on, you got to write when you're doing an op-ed, you put your name on it. This is an op-ed. Put your darn name on the thing. And to me, that's that fundamental. It's that basic, and it just shows the state of journalism, I think, today in some of our mainstream press.
Yes, and so is the state of some people too. I mean, to have the audacity to do that and brag about it, think that they're doing something patriotic. I mean, I wish a Roto-Rooter upon the White House to get rid of the.
This unnamed source was probably never had their name on a ballot. Probably weren't elected by the American people.
Yes.
So this is
and subverting.
Yeah, this is not how the Constitution envisioned our the greatest country ever and our government working. So that's unfortunate as well.
Congressman Jordan, your name is very familiar to my listeners because I talk about you all the time. Mm-hmm. But Congressman Jordan is the congressman from Ohio who I personally and many of us really hope and pray will be the new Speaker of the House.
Thank you.
And I so appreciate you throwing your hat in the ring and doing everything you can to win that, Congressman.
Yeah.
Let me ask you something. Right now, the 2018 election is, what, 2 months away?
Mm-hmm. 61 days as we're talking.
So, and a poll showed that the American people are really concerned, I think the number is like 60%, about immigration.
Mm-hmm.
But you wouldn't know that from the leadership of the Republican Party. You certainly wouldn't know it from the Democrats because they want to abolish ICE and all the rest of it. So there's really a big chasm.
Yeah.
But we've got leadership of the House not willing to even fund a border. I'm curious to know, if you were Speaker, how would that be different? You still have the same membership.
You got to start early. You got to have the full debate. You certainly need the president, who is, as I kind of like to say, is pretty darn good at conveying a message. You need to start.
Oh no, he's inarticulate.
Yeah,
he mumbles. He doesn't know what he's doing.
He's good, as you know. You need him to weigh in on that debate. You got to start early, and you have to put it on a must-pass spending bill. You know, this town may not want it. It's obvious the establishment doesn't want, but the American people do.
Yes.
And this was probably the single biggest promise that the American people remember, that we all as Republicans campaigned on in 2016. Certainly a central issue for the president securing the nomination in the Republican Party and then becoming the president of the United States. So it's something we got to get done. The president has had an amazing year and a half. He really has.
Yeah, when he says it, it's really true.
And think about it. In a year and a half, regulations reduced, taxes lowered, economy growing at 4.2%, unemployment lowest in 20 years, Gorsuch on the court, Kavanaugh on deck, out of the Iran deal, embassy going to Jerusalem, and the hostages have been returned from North Korea. That's amazing, right? Now, but we still haven't got done some of the key things we talked about, and that's because Congress hasn't. We help with the tax cuts, and I don't want to downplay that, but Where's the border security wall? Where's the welfare reform? Where's the repeal of Obamacare? Those things haven't got done. And front and center was this border security wall. Let's get it done.
Yeah, well, so here's an American citizen listening to my show. And they do listen every morning all over the country. And they actually love the country. And they're facing the 2018s. And they hear me preach every day that the 2018s are so important. But then they see the leadership, sometimes those that are Republicans, not performing. They see the House and especially the Senate doing some really bad things, actually. So how should they feel about this 2018 midterm? Give them some perspective.
You got to understand the contrast. Understand what the Democrats are campaigning on and if they're successful, what they're going to try to do. They're very straightforward about this. They're trying now to walk some of it back, but really if they get elected and they take over the House, they're going to try to raise your taxes, they're going to abolish ICE, they're going to continue to socialize medicine, and they are going to impeach the President of the United States, the guy that we all elected. They're going to try to do that. There's no running away from that. Senator Gillibrand in New York has talked about abolishing ICE. Some of these new candidates who've won, the young lady who won in New York, the young lady who won in Massachusetts have talked about this, the socialist agenda they have. So that is what they're going to contrast that with what the president has accomplished, their resistance versus the results that we have secured on the Republican side. That's what this election's about, and that's why it's important they come out and support Republicans.
So another bad topic. You guys are in budget talk. You're voting every day. You're talking about the budget. And it's now taking the form of minibuses as opposed to this omnibus. And the big boast, of course, is that they're finally getting a budget approved by both houses. At least it seems it's in the works.
Yeah.
But some of you and some of us are not real happy about the details of that. And as a conservative congressman who has been absolutely unwavering on fiscal responsibility, this is tough for you guys, isn't
it? Yeah. Well, we blew our the opportunity was there back in the spring, right before Easter, when the big omnibus bill passed. That was the opportunity that we had to change how this place works. But instead of funding our troops at a higher level and then holding the line and not increasing spending on everything else, the pattern continued that started a few years back under Obama and Harry Reid, where for every dollar Republicans want for national defense, Democrats will hold up that, which is supposed to be a separate bill, they'll hold that up and say, nope, you don't get that until we also get same increase in non-defense spending, in social welfare spending, in just big government. We had a chance to break that because if you remember, even before that, Chuck Schumer we had sent him a short-term funding bill for like 3 weeks as we're in this negotiation. He got it on a Friday and he said, you know what? Amnesty is more important than funding the troops. Remember this?
I do remember
that.
And
he said, I'm going to shut the government down over that weekend, which I always think is interesting because shutting the government down over a weekend is sort of redundant. But he said he was going to do it.
Should have done it Friday noon. That would have been more realistic because they shut down then.
Yeah. So he shuts the government down over the weekend. And over the weekend, the American people said, you're crazy, right? The amnesty more important than our troops are. What are you talking about? So on Monday, he comes back in and says, you know, Shazam, I'm going to open the government back up because he had saw what was happening politically. That was the backdrop. Move to that omnibus bill. We had a chance to break the pattern.
Yes.
If we'd have just been willing to have the full debate, and the president understood it as well, but instead our leadership says, no, let's just do what the swamp always does. Let's just spend more money on everything, drive up the debt even more. Largest discretionary spending increase in history, 2,232-page bill that we had 15 hours to look at, 1 hour to debate. Funding things we said we wouldn't, like Planned Parenthood, not funding things we said we would, like the border security wall, and you're supposed to vote for that? Come on. So the key is, start early, have the debate, engage the president, who is, as we said before, so good at conveying a message.
You know, I'll speak of the House right now. I could speak of the Senate, but we both know, and I'll say this for you, that the House is filled with members who've been funded by the establishment. Not everybody. We've got the Freedom Caucus and some others, independents who are pretty steadfast. But we have a majority of Republicans, anyway, who really are part of the, to one degree or another, part of the swamp, have been elected by the swamp or funded by the swamp. Do you think, though, that because the leadership is just not willing to do anything about anything, basically, do you think there's some restlessness among even people that we might be surprised?
Oh, yeah, I think members, members are frustrated with how the place operates, because they view it as not operating, not working in the way it's supposed to, not in the way the founders envisioned it would work. And it's really, I think, way too much of a few people at the top making all the decisions, and then everyone is told to fall in line, where I think the model in America is unique. We're a, I mean, think about the document that defines our country, we the people. Our model is the only one in history where it's a grassroots, bottom-up model, where we, the people, loan power to government to protect the rights God gave us, our fundamental liberties. And the House of Representatives, the body closest to the people, is supposed to operate in that kind of manner where every single member is empowered via the committee process to put together legislation that's consistent with what the voters elected us to do and get those things accomplished and into public policy. That's not working. It's a top-down model. It's the speaker and the leader and a few people at the top doing all the big bills and saying, oh, now all of you vote for it. Well, last time I checked, every single member in the House represents approximately 750,000 people. We all come from equal-sized districts. We all have folks back home who elected us to go do certain things. Let's empower the members. And that's the kind of model I think makes sense, would result in better policy, and is consistent with how America is supposed to work.
And do you think that your fellow members kind of want that?
I do, because way too many of them. We got young, sharp people. Yeah. Not all of them are young, sharp people, but we got sharp people who just are left out of the process way too much.
All right, so... Okay, let's talk about the 2018 before I let you go. If you were to predict, and I just heard a rundown yesterday that sounded pretty abysmal. I heard that the Republicans on an average of polls are down by 9 percentage points. I wonder what I don't know where those polls are coming from.
Yeah.
It's an average, but what's your information on that?
Well, look, historically it's tough the first midterm after a new president comes in. I understand that. I will tell you, Donald Trump is beating the odds. He's beating all the predictions, all the conventional wisdom. And I think the more we nationalize this election, the more we talk about the things that have been accomplished, the great economy, the unemployment, the low rate, the good folks on the court, the tax cuts and all, and contrast that with the Democrats' message of raising your taxes, abolishing ICE, socializing medicine even more, and impeaching the president, I think we can win. I think we're going to win. I know the polls aren't great right now, but let's go talk about the things that we have done and the things we still need to get done, and contrast that with the crazy left-wing policies that they're advocating.
You know, one encouraging sign, this is not a poll, but during those funerals for John McCain back-to-back and Aretha Franklin, which was all the talk over that weekend, there was a rally in Evansville, Indiana, where the president went to speak. And it used to be Roberts Stadium. I don't know what they call it now.
Yeah.
But the place, from all reports, had never had such a crowd. It was total capacity with 2,000 people waiting outside.
Yeah.
I think it was a Thursday night.
Yeah.
So you know what? That's not a poll, but that should say something.
Oh, I've been to some of the president's, Sandy, you're right. I've been to some of the president's rallies. We were at one here about a month ago for the special election in Ohio, and they turned thousands away. It was a powerful, and the president won that race for Troy, because Troy was losing in the early vote, in the absentee vote, 64-36, and he winds up winning when the president comes in on a Saturday night, a few days later. So we had the president in Ohio for the big Republican Party event, and record crowd for our GOP state event. So you're right, the president, because regular folks, I call them second shift workers and second grade teachers and regular folks, hardworking people who make this country such a special place, deep down they're so fed up with this establishment and this town, and they see this guy, this president, as coming in and taking on the swamp, and they appreciate that.
And speaking their language, and by the way, just on that night, it was so fun to watch, because you didn't expect to be on the stage, did you?
I didn't.
That was really funny.
The president was very kind and called me up. Yeah.
Yes, he called you up, and you know what? I'll just say it. I think that was a God moment, because I know that Congressman Mark Meadows is generally out of the Freedom Caucus, the one that talks to the president the most, not you. And so when you got up, you just packed a power punch, as you always do.
You're kind.
You got so much in, and the president's face, it was fun to watch.
Yeah, it was
so
a fun time.
I thought that was a, you know what, God's given you those gifts, and now you got to use them.
Well,
are
you
are you are you excited about being speaker now that you decided that you will are willing to put your name out there, or do you kind of dread it because you know what's coming with it?
Well, look, I mean, we're not the favorite. It's an uphill fight. The grassroots, though, response has been tremendous,
yes.
As we talked about. So we'll see. My attitude is I'm frustrated because I don't think the things are getting done that all the things are getting done that we promised the voters we're going to do, and more importantly, that they elected us to do. I want to focus on that one singular goal. Do what we said. Let's get that done. And if we keep the majority, and I'm given the chance to lead, we're going to do that. It's, you know, it'll be a tough job. I understand that, but we'll see.
Well, we will see. And lots of people are rooting for you, Congressman.
Thank you.
And meanwhile, you have your own district to represent, which you're doing faithfully, and you play an important role. Whether the Republicans win the House and you have a chance even to be Speaker or not, you know, I guess it's just we do our best,
yep.
whatever the circumstances,
yep.
right? All right, Congressman, you're an inspiration. Thank you
no,
so
you
much.
Thank God, you, Sandy.
God bless and keep you and your family. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
All righty.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
I'm Sandy Rios back with you, and sitting in front of me is a legend in his own time. His name is Michael Harrison. He's the publisher and editor of Talkers Magazine. Let me just say that Michael has been described in the New York Times as the unofficial dean of the radio industry. Talkers Magazine is referred to them by them as the industry's leading trade publication. Well, it is. See, they don't have to say it. Even though I don't trust most of what they say, that one is true. USA Today.
That was their last truth.
Yeah, that's the last time they spoke the truth. Now, Michael, you're not supposed to have political opinions. USA Today called Michael the talk radio guru, while The Nation dubbed him the wise old owl of talk radio business. Well, now, do you like that moniker?
I'm not so sure I like any of it. But
some of that's pretty good, I think.
As long as they're not throwing eggs, you know, I'm okay.
Michael, how long have you been the editor of Talkers?
28 years.
And did Talkers exist before then?
I'm the founder of Talkers, and right now I'm basically, you know, the image of it, but it's a great staff, and, you know, I could get to do things like this and do interviews and be out there talking about the issues, yeah. and I don't do most of the actual hard work is done by a great staff.
Talkers is known to the industry, people in the industry, but I don't think most people might know. So tell them
Talkers is a trade publication.
Would explain it.
It's not aimed at the public or the general public. It's aimed at the industry, and it super serves the industry. And I don't think there's anybody in radio, not just talk radio, but radio in general, that doesn't know of or devoted to reading Talkers every day.
Did you start a radio yourself?
I've been in radio for 51 years. I still am on radio all the time.
Really?
I fill in at WRKO in Boston, WTIC in Hartford, WMAL in Washington, KSCO in San Jose, California. We have national shows that I participate in. I have been on radio for years, and I started as a radio personality. So, I mean, you can hear I have a radio
voice. Yes, yeah, I can. Of course I can hear
voice.
That. Oh, yes, I do hear that. You know, it's funny. Do you always have a radio voice when you talk? Or if you're having dinner with your wife, do you sound like this?
That's a very interesting question. I think there's a little bit of change for everybody when they're on camera or on microphone or on stage. Mm-hmm. But over the years, the thing that I learned that as I improved from being a neophyte, once I was, you know, my first broadcast, I can remember that when I was a kid. I started in my teens, was to be as natural in your own voice in your own style as you can be, as the content became more important than the form. When it started, you know, hello, you're on the radio, now the news. But we're dealing with complicated issues. We're dealing with communicating ideas.
From the heart.
Yeah, you can't be too concerned with some kind of posturing when you're doing that.
Well, and people can tell that, and you do lose heart. I find my own, I didn't come from an area of the country where you speak well. So when I was first given a radio show, I thought, you don't want me. And so I had to sort of perfect my
speech
a little bit.
Where were you from? Where?
Southern Illinois.
Oh, okay.
So we talked sort of a mushy, kind of lazy, pretty Southern.
Well, I'm from Brooklyn, and if I go back to what I was in theater as a kid, and I always was concerned about, making a good presentation.
Are you a singer, musician?
I'm a music appreciator. I have a musical talent to a certain degree in terms of I could write a little song, sometimes for bumper music, which is the accompanying music on radio shows. With computerization now, I'm able to hack out a little piano piece or a flute piece. We have all these instruments in our smartphones, but I'm not really a musician. And I wish I could sing as well as I speak, but I can't.
I guess my point in asking the question, I do think that often radio people who have pleasing voices, there is a musical ear, because it is about hearing. There's a strong correlation between hearing music and listening and responding and voice and all of that. Anyway, I just think it's an interesting...
I'm old school in broadcasting, in as much as I see the radio show as being like a symphony. A lot of people who don't come from the earlier days of radio, when radio stations were programmed from beginning to end, every element was blended and was important, and the DJ or the announcer worked themselves into it the way a singer with a band would
totally.
Be doing
that
it.
Was my background.
That
too.
Was my background. Yeah. Today, a lot of people in radio, they don't have that broadcasting sensibility, so they sound disjointed and awkward.
Right. Yeah, I'm in my best form when I've got great music and production behind me.
Mm-hmm.
I rise to the occasion. When it's just my voice, I can't.
You have a nice voice, though. You're very, I've never met you before, and you're an impressive woman.
Well, thank you. That's very sweet of you. Now, here's the check. No. Hey, all right, so let me ask you, obviously I love talk radio, and we've seen it change, and there was a time I actually did a Chicago talk market for many years, 3 hours drive time. But there was a time when we thought talk radio was going to wane a bit because of the advent of all these different forms of getting information. I think the pendulum has swung with podcasts and internet and all that. I don't know if you would agree with me. I don't think talk radio...
Swung which way?
Swung, I think it's getting stronger, not weaker, because of the advent of different ways of listening.
If it integrates all of the new tools and the new technologies into its into its reach, then it will, of course, get stronger as technology makes anything stronger.
But you don't think it has?
If it's used properly. I think it has. But I think that the radio industry is facing tough times, and that affects all formats. Talk is consistently the top format.
Yeah.
Talk has saved not just AM, it's saved radio, in my opinion.
Right.
And I think that there'll always be talk shows. Now, if radio as a business wants to enjoy that, they have to embrace the internet, they have to embrace podcasting and all the apps and all of this technological breakthrough. But I don't think that talk shows will ever go away.
Well, it's funny. My son is... in Scotland now. He's studying at the university over there, and he misses talk radio.
Yeah, they don't have it around the country like they have it in America.
No.
American talk radio is a unique brand of programming.
I know it, but that is my point. It isn't available, and we would miss it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, though. My son may be the exception. Of course, he grew up in a different kind of house, but most young people... I don't know what the stats are. Maybe you do.
Well, young people, radio itself has a problem maintaining young audiences because young people have not grown up where that appliance known as the radio was the icon of their existence.
Yeah.
So there is that problem. There's a generational divide, and that's an issue that we could talk for hours about, and I'll spare you that just to say that's an issue. However, young people do listen to audio. young people do listen to podcasts.
Right, exactly.
And not all radio, not all talk radio is political talk radio. There's sports talk radio. There's relationships talk radio. There's all kinds of talk radio. It frustrates me as the publisher of Talkers magazine when people tend to say talk radio and then they immediately pigeonhole it as conservative news talk radio. There's more to it than that. That's a great format. But there are other formats, too.
You know, Michael Medved used to be, well, he still is a good friend. I just don't see him very often. But I heard him speak on something once that I will never forget. He said that the reason that talk, now I'm talking about the political part of talk radio.
Right.
The reason talk radio works so well for conservatives is that they think in ideas and concepts while the left think in, they are more visual. They think, they see things, they have an emotional response.
There's a degree of truth to that.
Yeah.
I would say, elaborating on that, that one of the reasons conservative news talk radio has been more successful commercially than liberal news talk radio is because from a targeting standpoint, conservatives are more of a unified, cohesive target. And it's all about targeting audiences today, whereas liberals are many different lifestyles, many different disorganized and not necessarily homogenized.
Oh, that's interesting.
From a broadcasting perspective. Remember, we're still broadcasting. It's still the radio business. It's entertainment. And the targeting is the key. Liberals are harder to target as liberals.
You know, the attacks against talk radio, conservative talk radio, have been kind of quieter. The new way, of course, attacking is to attack the advertisers, and the left has been very successful at that. Do you see more of that happening?
I see that as part of the mix, and it's an unfortunate thing. Because advertising is the lifeblood of so much of our communications, going for advertisers and harassing them, it's dirty pool. They have the freedom to do that. It's not against the letter of the law, First Amendment-wise, but it's against the spirit of free speech. It's playing dirty. And it's unfortunate. People should understand that the remedy to free speech is more free speech. Don't try to shut anybody down. There's enough media out there for everybody. And when you try to shut somebody down, you're not really helping your own cause at all. If anything, it's quite un-American to do that.
Yeah.
So I don't like it.
No, I don't either. I'm really grateful, though, for right now, there haven't been any, at least as far as I know, there have been the attacks against us for the fairness doctrine and other ways have not, that's kind of quiet now.
The fairness doctrine will never come back. Again, I won't chew your ear off about it, but just...
You don't think so?
Not a chance. Not a chance. It will not come back.
Well, but I do think if things change in Washington and the leadership, I think they'll be after talk radio. I think we'll be one of the first targets because really and truly we...
That'll only make it stronger.
Yeah. Well, I hope you're right about that.
Don't you think... I mean, I assume that you're a Trump supporter or at least sympathetic to him. Don't you think that the attacks on Trump are only giving more commitment to his base and making him stronger?
Yes, but I also know that I'm going to the extreme. In totalitarian societies, they are able to shut people up conclave them, shut them off, and isolate them, and bring their... We know that in Russia, I think of Solzhenitsyn and all the great intellectual writers, it is possible to shut it all down and to silence us, and I do think that's the goal. I don't want it to happen, but I think it's the goal. Michael, as I look around at this Radio Row, I know there are a lot of... I don't sense that, everyone's, old. I mean, there are a lot of young people here,
and we
have some great young talk show host talent, don't you think?
Yeah, indeed. For the most part, it's an upper demographic industry, but yes, it is. There are young people doing it. It's a myth that it's all old, gray-haired white men. That's not true. There are a lot of them, and some of them should be there. There should be no bias against anybody for their age or their race, one way or the other. But no, there is some good young talent.
I think when it comes to talk radio, my personal theory is you have to have a lot of life experience and a lot of understanding to do a decent talk show.
Yeah, you get exposed very quickly after 3 hours on the air every day if you don't have life experience.
Yeah, exactly.
Life experience is crucial to this kind of thing. Television's different. You know, you have writers, it's quick, it's bing, bang, boom, but you're out there, spontaneously talking about nuances and real life, and if you don't have a lot of life experience, that's shown very quickly.
You know, when I was very young, I sang with the U.S. Army Band in Europe, and Armed Forces Network wanted to interview me. I'll never forget it. It's the first time I'd ever been on radio. And I just remember, I still remember how I felt. It was like, I didn't have anything to say. Well, what? There's nothing about me. I mean, I don't know why. You know, I just remember I had nothing to say. And who would have known that my life would end in a very different tapestry?
Well, being aware that you had nothing to say was the first step toward having something to say. I hear a lot of people with nothing to say who don't know they have nothing to say.
They're
on the radio or they're doing what they're doing for the sake of doing it, as opposed to having a mission to express and communicate something. They just to hear their gums flap.
No, that's true. I say that. I feel that way too, Michael, that some talk show hosts just love to hear themselves talk.
Yes.
You know? But I think you have to have something really to contribute. Mm-hmm. It's not just the way you talk. It's not just your voice. It is your life experience, your world view, the way you're able to think. You know, Rush Limbaugh has had some great substitute young hosts, I think, in the last few years, mm-hmm. who have been, I don't know how young they are. They sound young. But anyway, so I guess there are some exceptions to that. No. All right, as you pass the baton on to talk radio, what would you recommend as the next step?
The next step for
talk radio to keep it strong. What would you suggest?
Don't preach to the choir as heavily as it does. Okay. Don't be afraid to upset the apple cart. Don't be afraid to tweak and provoke your fans. It goes back to radio programming, back to music radio. If you only play the songs that your listeners want to hear, you'll get a smaller and smaller but happier audience. You have to take chances. You have to take risks because the scenario is not stagnant. Every day things change, and don't rely on the public mood being stable. Because you'll suddenly find that the parade you think you're leading has gone down a different street, and you'll be by yourself.
Absolutely. Michael Harrison, publisher and editor of Talkers Magazine. Michael, it's been a pleasure.
Indeed.
Will you come and consult and critique me and make me better?
I'm going to make... You're pretty darn good, let me tell you.
You're very sweet. All right. Okay, thank you so much.